Today on Maine Calling, U.S. Senator Angus King on the state of democracy. Senator Angus King is making noise. He's gone on 60 Minutes, written an essay for Time magazine, talked with Esquire magazine and historian Heather Cox Richardson, and given speeches on the Senate floor. King's message? Our democracy is in peril. Our nation is in the most dangerous place since its founding. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we ask Senator King about these dire warnings and what comes next. Do his Senate colleagues, Democrat and Republican, share his view? Do citizen protests matter? What will he do if there's the constitutional crisis he predicts? Plus, answers to your questions about issues facing Congress. Senator Angus King on Maine Calling, just ahead.
Maine Calling On Demand is made possible in part by Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure with 19 locations across the state, now open in Bangor and Waterville. And by Verrill, committed to delivering trusted legal services in Maine and throughout the Northeast for 163 years. Learn more at verrill-law.com.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today, our guest will be U.S. Senator Angus King, first elected to the U.S. Senate in 2012. He currently serves in four oversight committees, Veterans Affairs, Intelligence, Armed Services, and Energy and Natural Resources. We will invite you to join the conversation with your questions for Senator King. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. We are expecting Senator King to join us at any moment. Apparently some problem with the internet connection in the location where he is. So we are hoping that he can get a call into us very soon. But we are going to leave you for just a couple minutes, and we'll be right back, hopefully, with Senator Angus King. Welcome back. This is Jennifer Rooks. We have Senator Angus King with us now, hoping that the internet issues have been resolved. Senator King, can you hear me? You still coming online?
I can. Can you hear me, Jennifer?
We can. Thank you. And what a relief.
Sorry to be late. I just spent the morning, since early this morning, with the Secretary of Navy at BIW, touring the yard, and I had to get into a facility where I could connect. So I'm sorry to be late, but it was in a good cause. I was, helping to introduce the new Secretary of Navy to BIW. So that's part of my job. But now I'm with you, and look forward to a discussion.
Well, I do appreciate your, fitting us in, finding a quiet room at Bath Ironworks so that you can join us and our audience. Senator King, you've been one of the most outspoken voices out there recently. You are telling everyone who will listen that you believe our democracy is in peril, that this is the most dangerous time for our nation since its founding. What do you say to people who might be rolling their eyes, thinking that you're exaggerating?
Well, I think the problem is, Jennifer, you have to sort of separate the policies of the administration from the manner in which they're pursuing those policies. And people can argue about, mass deportations or defunding AID or the Department of Education. You know, those are policy issues. The problem is they're being addressed by this administration without regard to the Constitution. For example, a federal agency, AID, for example, is created by act of Congress, signed by the president. And in order to abolish it, it takes another act of Congress, not the unilateral action of the executive. The same thing with a lot of these actions that are being taken that really sort of collapse our constitutional structure, which was designed to keep all power out of one set of hands. That's the basic premise of the Constitution. It's a cliche to talk about checks and balances, but that's really what we're talking about here. And the checks and balances aren't checking and balancing. And so this really isn't about Democrat or Republican or what your views on immigration are. It's a question of how our governmental system will work. And what I'm alarmed about is if we end up with a situation where the major powers of the government are all in one set of hands, that's dangerous. History tells us that. James Madison in the 47th Federalist, pretty smart guy, principal author of the Constitution, said this: when all power is concentrated, when judicial, executive, and legislative power is concentrated in one set of hands, that's a perfect definition of tyranny. That's the word he used, tyranny. And that's what's dangerous. So even though you may agree with what the president is doing, it's the way it's being done that's dangerous for you, for anybody in the country, because once this sort of fundamental alteration of how our Constitution is supposed to work takes place, the next president may be somebody you don't like, and you're going to not like it when they have these kinds of powers. So that's what's worrying me, Jennifer, is the collapse of the constitutional structure that all of us in the Congress took an oath to defend. And it's there, not because the framers wanted it to be complicated, I'm not complaining about it because of loss of power of the Senate or institutional jealousy. I'm worried about setting out on a path that compromises the very basis, the separation of powers that's there to protect us all. And that's why I'm sounding the alarm on the 250th anniversary of the midnight ride of Paul Revere. Mary says I'm a combination of Paul Revere and Chicken Little. But this is a serious problem, and it's one that I deeply hope we can address.
In private conversations, do your Senate colleagues, Democrats and Republicans, agree with your assessment? Are they also worried about what this means for our democracy?
Well, it varies, and you know, it's hard to focus on something like this larger picture of the constitutional structure when we're being deluged by daily developments of, you know, defunding Harvard or mass deportations or people being sent to El Salvador or, you know, whatever the issue of the day is. The tariffs, of course, is a big issue. But I think my colleagues are starting to wake up to this problem. I've made a speech a while ago. I said, when are we going to wake up? When are we going to draw some red lines here about how these activities are supposed to take place? Another example is executive orders. Executive orders are not law. The president seems to think that's law. In his famous exchange with Governor Mills, he said, "We are the law." I'm sorry, that's not what the Constitution says. The Constitution says his job in Article 2 is to, quote, faithfully execute the laws, not decide which laws he likes and doesn't like. And by the way, an appropriations bill, Jennifer, is a law. So he doesn't get to decide, oh, I don't think I'm going to fund Maine, or I'm not going to fund some program in Georgia or somewhere else that I don't like. That's not the way our system is supposed to work. Now, back to my colleagues. My Republican colleagues, I think, understand sort of what's going on, but they don't really want to talk about it. And the response I often get is, well, you're raising a good point, but the courts will take care of it. Well, that's putting a lot of weight on the courts, and the courts may take care of it, but recently it appears that the administration isn't all that liable to obey court orders. And we just had another one yesterday from the U.S. Court of Appeals that made it very clear that what they're doing with these mass deportations with no due process whatsoever, which is required by the Constitution for all persons, not just citizens, all persons, is a gross violation of the Constitution. So I'm worried that we can't simply rely on the courts. The other two guardrails are the Congress, and frankly, we've been derelict. The Congress is not doing its job. It's not doing its oath, which our oath was to defend. Here's something interesting, Jennifer. Our oath is to defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. I think it's kind of interesting that the framers anticipated domestic enemies of the Constitution, and that's our job. But they say, well, the courts will take care of it. But here's a little bit of optimism. One of the big issues recently has been tariffs. The Constitution makes clear that trade among nations is a specific responsibility of the Congress. Some years ago, the Congress essentially delegated that power to the president, but only in an emergency. In other words, it's not an open-ended, you can do anything you want on tariffs. It had to be an emergency, but this president has basically declared whatever he wants as an emergency. It's hard to convince people in Maine there's an emergency with regard to Canada, for example, or with regard to France or Denmark. There's no emergency, but here's the point I wanted to make about optimism. Last week, a bipartisan group of senators, 7 Republicans, 7 Democrats, filed a bill to pull this tariff power back to the Congress. And I think it's very significant. The lead sponsors are Maria Cantwell, Democrat of Washington, and Chuck Grassley, who I think is sort of Mr. Republican from Iowa in the Senate. And they finally have said, okay, here's a place where we're going to draw the line. And I'm hoping that's an indicator that when we get back to Washington, that we're going to see more steps to make the checks and balances operate as they should.
Senator King, my next question was going to be about the recent statement by Senator Lisa Murkowski, but it looks like Doug in Meredith, New Hampshire, wants to ask you that question. So I'll have Doug do the asking. Doug, go ahead.
We let people in New Hampshire ask questions?
They listen to us.
Well, okay.
Go ahead, Doug.
I think they have to be Bowdoin grads.
Oh, okay.
Now I'm okay?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Lisa Murkowski recently, I think it was about 2 days ago, admitted on camera when asked by her constituents what's going on in Washington and why she wasn't taking more of an active role. She said, I'm afraid because retribution is real. So I would just like you to speak to that comment because this is a pervasive question that I hear from my Republican and Democrat and independent friends. What's going on with the Republicans? Do they not care about the country?
Doug, thank you for that question. And I believe she said, I'm afraid. And I believe she also said, we are all afraid. Senator King.
Well, you know, I let's be honest, and I don't think anybody can deny this, that part of what seems to be motivating the president these days is revenge. And he issued 2 executive orders that were really chilling a couple of weeks ago, directed against individuals who he didn't like. One was Chris Krebs, former head of CISA, the cybersecurity agency. And he was mad at Chris Krebs because Chris Krebs said that the election in 2020 was safe. And the president didn't agree with that. And then he issued another executive order taking security clearances away and ordering investigations of a guy named Taylor who had worked in the administration and wrote a critical book. Well, when the power of the presidency is being put in to go after one individual, what does that tell everyone else in the government and outside the government? Don't cross this guy. He's going to use the power of the office to come after you. He's going to sick the Justice Department on you. I refer to it as the department formerly known as Justice, but he's going to sick the Justice Department on you. And I think that's what Lisa Murkowski was talking about. And of course, my Republican colleagues in the Senate are also facing the prospect of we will primary you. And the new threat is we will primary you and Musk will pay for it. That's a kind of double-barreled threat. You're going to have a primary if you go against us, and that your opponent's going to have unlimited funds. So I think Lisa, I told Lisa about 5 years ago, I thought she had the highest integrity quotient of anyone in the Senate. She is smart and absolutely honest and straightforward. So it's no surprise to me that she's the one that said the quiet part out loud over the last few days.
Senator King, I want to ask you talked about retribution. You talked about being primaried.
What about the threat of violence? Do you believe members of Congress are afraid that supporters of Trump would, of President Trump, would act out against themselves or their families?
Well, I haven't seen the recent figures, but I know that as of fairly recently, last year or so, threats against members of Congress have gone up four or five times, or they more than doubled from where they were, you know, in 2014 and 15. So there certainly are that's a consideration. Threats are they come in, they come to our offices, and it is something that is on people's minds, and I have heard that sort of quietly from some of my colleagues that they're worried about their families. That's not a good place. This isn't where we should be in this country.
Doug, thank you for your question. I'm going to go up to Falmouth and Jessica. Hi, Jessica. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. First of all, Senator King, I wanted to thank you and tell you how proud I am that you're our senator. Thank you for all you're doing. I'm curious what you think can be done if the Trump administration were to openly and clearly defy a Supreme Court order. I think there was arguably a bit of an out in the one regarding Kilmar, the man from Maryland who was mistakenly deported. What can Trump actually do, assuming you have the support of enough Republicans, and also if you don't?
Okay, Jessica, you cut out a little bit, but you're asking what can Congress do, right?
What can anyone do if there's a defying of court order? I think, is that right? I think that was the question.
What can Congress do?
Well, let me talk generally. I think the defiance of a court order will be a red line, I hope, for many of my colleagues, and to try to move and make something happen. And I have to tell you, one of the most common comments I get at the office, and as of last week, we've gotten more emails, calls, letters, as of the middle of April than we did all last year combined. So people are really engaged. But one of the comments is, why don't you fix it? Angus, why don't you stop it? Put a stop to this. Well, the problem is I don't have the votes. And the majority so far has been very reluctant. As I say, there's a little green shoot here with this tariff bill. And I believe that the open defiance of a court order may be another red line that will move my colleagues toward finally saying enough is enough. There are three guardrails. One is the Congress, and as I said, we're not doing very well. The second is the courts. They're holding up their end pretty much. The third, though, is you, is the voters, is the people at home. And being engaged, talking to your neighbors, being in touch with your representatives in Washington is hugely important. And being out in public about your disfavor of what's going on. Elections, of course, are the final check, but there are no elections for 19 months. And if you think about all that's been done in the last 90 days, 19 months seems like an eternity. So I think the public has to really be thoroughly engaged on this issue, be out front, be in public, put pressure on people like me, and hopefully this will happen all over the country, and I'll have more allies. But that's where we are right now. I just had an essay published this morning in Time magazine, and one of my lines was, at this moment, apathy is not an option. And that's exactly where we are.
Senator King, many people are asking about sort of the mechanism of this, though. Even if you had allies, then what could happen? How could there be enforcement if the administration continues to defy court orders?
Well, the majority has the power to, for example, say, okay, we're not approving any more nominees. And here's their major point of leverage. The president's big focus is this tax bill, this major tax cut bill. If they said, okay, we're not going to do anything with this tax bill until you get back in constitutional order of obeying court orders, not acting unilaterally with regard to agencies of the federal government, not impounding funds, not using your power to intimidate people like law firms and universities. In other words, there's some leverage, there's some power, but it'll take the majority. It'll take you know, 47 won't do it. It's going to take more like 50 or 55 or 60. And so Congress does have power. And as I mentioned, we passed a bill 2 weeks ago that by a bipartisan vote that basically said there's no emergency at the Canadian border, and therefore the whole Canadian tariff thing should be pulled back. That was passed in the Senate, as I say, on a bipartisan basis. The problem is the Speaker of the House won't bring it up. And that's a separate problem, whether or not the House is going to take the necessary actions to rein in the president. But I'm hopeful that the overreach is going to become so obvious that it's going to be very hard for members of Congress of either party to ignore it and to not take cognizance of what's going on. And to go back to the beginning, I don't want to overdo it too much, but we're talking about a fundamental attack on the structure of our government. We're talking about a shifting of essentially, and if we talk about ignoring court orders, then everything is in one set of hands. And as I say, throughout history, we know that's a recipe for tyranny. That's a recipe for despotism. And I don't care if the Archangel Gabriel is the president. If all the power is there, it's gonna be a bad outcome. The people are gonna be abused. And there's an old saying, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And we've got to wake up to this, to the deeper problem, which is the undermining. Undermining is too mild a word. The usurpation of the separation of powers, which is at the heart of what of the design of the Constitution. It's why they didn't want a king. They made it very clear. They didn't. They had just fought an 8-year war against a king. The Declaration of Independence, if you go back and read it, is addressed to the king. And they were very intent that they did not want a monarch in this country. And for us to allow a monarchy to sort of evolve over, well, it's pretty fast, over several months, is totally antithetical to the whole premise of the Constitution.
Jessica, thanks for your question. We'll go up to Rangeley and James. Hi, James. Go ahead.
Yes, Senator King, I guess your memory is a little bit different than mine. We remember Biden being in there, and he used the Department of Justice against Republicans and Trump. And so when you say, you know, the justice is in peril here, what about the last 4 years when Biden and the Democrats ran the whole thing? And for another thing, you keep saying you're an independent, but when have you ever been independent with the Republicans? You always vote Democrat.
Well, in the last Trump administration, I voted for 75% of his nominees. I started out this time voting for a series of his nominees until things went sideways. So I've stopped doing that. But I've been involved in all kinds of, I'm involved in pretty much everything that goes on in the Senate that's bipartisan. The Great American Outdoors Act, the PACT Act for veterans, all of those things were bipartisan, working with both sides. That's what I do. Now, in terms of the use of the Justice Department, I think what's going on now is vastly different in terms of scope and scale than it was 4 years ago. There's no evidence, for example. I mean, I know it's a talking point, but there's no evidence that President Biden had anything to do with cases being brought in Georgia or in New York by state officials, not federal officials, or the various work that's done. I served on the Intelligence Committee. I've worked for 4 years with Republicans. By the way, it was a Republican majority during that time that we worked on the report on what went on in the 2016 election between Russia and the Trump campaign. And it was entirely bipartisan. And we concluded that there was indeed a significant connection between the campaign and the Russians. So, you know, I don't think the charge that Biden politicized the Justice Department really stands up to the analysis of the facts. And I understand. And somebody said, well, Biden also tried to go around the Constitution to forgive student loans. I think that's true. And I don't think, you know, I think there are problems with that. But what's going on now is a hugely more, I guess. It's a much larger compromise of the constitutional structure. Biden never said, I have the power to destroy, you know, some department of government. And I don't believe he tried to impound funds. That's what's really worrying me. And it should worry you, because you may like what's going on now, but if we go 2, 4, 6, 8 years from now with a Democratic president who by precedent now has all this power, you're not going to like the results. My fight is not about Trump. It's not about Republicans and Democrats. It's about the Constitution and not allowing a change that we will all come to regret.
All right, James, thank you so much for your call. We'll move up to your hometown, Brunswick, and Simon. Hi, Simon, go ahead.
Hey, thanks for having me. I just wanted to say I've always been a huge fan and supporter as a fellow Brunswick resident, Senator King, and appreciate everything you're doing to kind of keep the current administration in check, as hard as that is. My question is a foreign policy one. I was recently disappointed to see both you and Senator Collins vote to continue to supply Israel with offensive weapons. My question is, are you pushing to tie any safeguards to kind of further aid to prevent further harm to civilians and human rights abuses?
Simon, thanks for that question. And Senator King, I'm going to let you know that Simon's question represents many of the emails we're also getting in right now.
Sure. Well, that's an absolutely fair question. If you'll recall, Simon, in the fall, I voted with Bernie Sanders on his resolution to cut off certain offensive weapons to Israel because of my concern, just as you raised, about civilian casualties, the way the Israelis had been pursuing the bombing campaign. In fact, a little bit over a year ago, I met directly in Tel Aviv with Prime Minister Netanyahu and told him the same thing. My exact words were, this bombing campaign is hurting Israel more than it is Hamas because of what it's doing to the status of Israel in the world. So I've been consistently critical. Now, we had a vote about 2 weeks ago, and I voted against Bernie this time because of the timing. At that moment, almost within 2 or 3 days, maybe it was even 24 hours of the time of that vote, there were some pretty delicate negotiations going on to try to get to another ceasefire and to bring Hamas to the table. My concern was a yes vote for Bernie would be a signal to Hamas that they should just hunker down and avoid negotiations and continue the harmful activities that they're doing. By the way, they in fact do use civilians as human shields. They do place their military assets in civilian infrastructure. So it was a question of the question of timing on that particular day or week that Bernie brought this issue up again. But I absolutely share the concern. As I say, I've met numerous times with the ambassador from Israel and been very critical. I remember one meeting where they had just been publicized where they had bombed a convoy of ambulances. And I looked at him and said, and he was saying, well, maybe there were Hamas people in the ambulance. I said, look, don't bomb ambulances. So I've been pretty strong on this, but this particular vote 2 weeks ago, I thought the timing was wrong and could actually prolong the conflict by encouraging Hamas to hunker down, not negotiate, and not find a settlement. We've got to find a settlement that brings peace. We've got to find a settlement that gives the Palestinians hope for a state, for their own sovereignty and self-determination. And that's been my position since long before this even started.
We are speaking with U.S. Senator Angus King. We'll be right back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. This is Maine Calling. We're speaking with U.S. Senator Angus King. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. We'll let you know that the lines are full right now. I'm going to go to an email here from Sam. President Trump has made it clear that he will retaliate against anyone who challenges his edicts, no matter how unconstitutional they may be. How can you strike a balance between standing up to the administration while protecting Maine's federal funding for critical programs? Senator King, that's a big question for the entire delegation.
It sure is, and it's one that I'm mindful of. Because as I mentioned, part of the motivation seems to be revenge, that people, he's going after people he doesn't like for some reason, for something that they said or did 4 or 5 years ago. So that is a concern. And of course, the prime example is Governor Mills and the confrontation at the White House, where all she said was, we'll follow the law. And he you know, went after her. And that was at that point that he said, we are the law, which I found one of the most chilling statements I've ever heard from a president. And so he's executing retribution against the state of Maine. They canceled the Sea Grant program. We're the only one of 24 in the country. Now that's been restored. They've threatened to cancel funding the University of Maine. Most of that's been restored when they figured out that the issue with the trans athlete was high school, not university. They apparently thought it was the university, which is an example of how this administration works. It's ready, fire, aim. But they're definitely trying to punish Maine. And again, that's a usurpation of power. That our system's not designed for a president to be vindictive because he doesn't like something a governor said. And other states should be worried about this because, you know, the next state could be, okay, you had a hurricane. We're not going to give you any emergency money because, you know, you weren't respectful. And to tell you how personal it was, you remember a week or so ago, he said, well, it can be all fixed if the governor apologizes. Well, that indicates that what he was really mad at was not the policy, but the fact that somebody dared to stand up to him. And that's a, you know, that's one more way that a president is, that this president is using the powers of the office in ways that just were never intended. Again, his obligation is to see that the laws are faithfully executed. That doesn't have to do with taking funding away from Maine farmers for food that's going to food banks because he's mad at the governor. I mean, that's not democracy. That's not the way our system is supposed to work. And the trans athlete issue is a serious issue, and it's one that's worth a lot of discussion. It's a hard one. I have a daughter who was an athlete throughout high school, and I asked her about it. Her response was interesting. Dad, it's such a small problem. I don't believe it's something that you need to pay attention to in Washington. I think there are two trans athletes in Maine. The NCAA says there are 10 out of 500,000 in the colleges across the country. So my question in Washington was, why is this a federal issue? Why shouldn't school boards, states, leagues make these decisions on behalf of their own students? And not have the federal government tell them exactly how to do this. You know, ironically, 2 or 3 years ago, the same people who are pushing this were telling us, oh, no, this is, you can't intrude on states' rights on the issue of abortion, for example. You have to let the states do what they want. The states' rights. Well, suddenly, states' rights doesn't count. It's sort of like they're for states' rights, except when they're not. I think the question is a fair one, and retribution is no way to govern. It's backward looking. We ought to be looking forward. And if you think about it, this administration hasn't really put forward any policy proposals to the Congress for laws that they want passed. It's been all executive action and this, you know, going after law firms who represented people that the president didn't like. I mean, that's a gross violation of our whole rule of law system. Going back to the Revolutionary War, John Adams represented the British soldiers in court after the Boston Massacre and established for all time that lawyers are expected to represent their clients, and you don't attribute to the lawyer the activities of the client. That's the way our legal system has worked. And now the president is going after law firms because they, you know, they worked with somebody that he didn't like. I think they even went after the Robert Mueller's law firm, where he hasn't worked for something like 10 years. So we should be governing about what are the issues facing the country. You know, the price of groceries, the price of goods in our stores, that's what we ought to be focused on. That's what he was elected to do. But so far, there's been very little of that. And of course, we haven't talked about tariffs yet. That isn't going to help those problems.
We'll go to Linda calling from Yarmouth. Hi, Linda. Go ahead.
Senator King, who is composing the executive orders? What are their names? Who is exercising executive power through President Trump? President Trump neither reads or writes the executive orders. We citizens have the right to know the names of the shadow government.
I think that's a really good question. In fact, I thought of that myself as to who's giving him legal advice. In his first administration, he had people around him who told him when he was violating the law or likely to violate the law or when something wasn't a bad idea. People like Jim Mattis at Defense, John Kelly, Chief of Staff, Don McGahn in the counsel's office. He doesn't seem to have that today. He only has people, he only has people around him who agree and think he's just, you know, the greatest thing going. And that's always dangerous for a leader. The short answer to your question is, I don't know. If I had to guess, I would say a lot of this is being done by this guy, Stephen Miller, who is the rabid anti-immigrant person who apparently is a very high, powerful advisor. He was the one during the famous signal chat about the bombing of Yemen. It was Stephen Miller who said, the president says, go ahead. In other words, it appeared to be he was the guy who was speaking for the president in that conversation, not the Secretary of Defense, not the Director of National Intelligence, but Stephen Miller in the White House. I think there are other people. Another guy that's behind the scenes doing a lot of this bad work, in my opinion, is a guy named Russell Vogt, V-O-U-G-H-T, who's the Director of Office of Management and Budget. He believes presidents can do anything. He believes presidents can do whatever they want. It's called the unitary executive theory. It goes back four or five, maybe 10 or 15 years. They can impound funds. They have the power to do anything they want. I don't know what constitution he's ever read, but it sure as hell isn't ours. So if I had to name two individuals, and I don't know what Musk's relationship with all this is. I don't think he's directly working on these kinds of issues, but I'd say it's probably most likely Stephen Miller and Russell Vogt and the people around them.
Linda, thanks for your question. Going to Tenants Harbor and Mike. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Hey, how are you today, Jennifer?
I'm good.
Good. How are you, Matt?
Good. Senator King, I just love the fact that you're from Maine because you are truly a voice in the wilderness in Washington. But one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about was the fact that if I had disclosed information like Hegseth and Steve Miller and those disclosed, I'd be sitting in Leavenworth right now. Why is there not something being done about that?
Well, of course, you're absolutely right. I mean, it was unbelievable. If a junior officer at the Pentagon had done that, they would, as you say, they'd at least be out of the military. They might well have been court-martialed. They might be in Leavenworth. It's so shocking to me. I interviewed Tulsi Gabbard, the Director of National Intelligence, and several other officials, and they just the CIA director. They're just going all over the place. Tulsi wouldn't even tell us what telephone she was using when she was on that chat. Was she using her home phone that's just subject to hacking by our adversaries? And then they kept saying, and I just went back and looked at the transcript, nothing was classified. Well, it may not have been formally stamped with the word classified, but man, if you're telling people what weapons you're using, when you're leaving and where you're headed, that's the definition of something that should be classified. And if somebody from Iran or from the Houthis or the Russians had been on that call instead of the executive or that chat, instead of the editor of the Atlantic, people would have died. Americans would have died. They'd have known those planes were coming. They'd have known what weapons we were using. So you're right. It was an egregious violation of national security, and nobody at all has paid any price. And, you know, if you go back in Donald Trump's history, his mentor in New York was a guy named Roy Cohn, who was a lawyer associated with Joseph McCarthy back in the 50s. And Roy Cohn's mantra was, never explain, never apologize, never admit error. And I'm afraid that's what might be, you know, they don't want to have the Atlantic win. So they're absolutely stonewalling this investigation. Fortunately, the chair, the Republican chair of the Armed Services Committee, Roger Wicker, and the ranking member, Jack Reed, have undertaken and put in motion an independent examination of what happened from the point of view of the Pentagon using the Inspector General. We don't know where that's going, but at least that something is happening. But the short answer to your question is nothing's happened to anybody because the people at the top aren't taking it seriously and don't want to admit that they made a mistake.
Mike, thanks for your call. An email here from Al. What should his constituents do if they or a loved one comes afoul of this administration, i.e., if someone's spouse is a naturalized citizen and is detained at a port of entry like the couple from Massachusetts were on the Vermont border, or if someone's a green card holder and is told that is being revoked while being arrested?
Jennifer, this is another example of why I'm so concerned, because they're just reaching everywhere. They seem to have a quota. I read recently that they want to have 1 million people by June or something. And whenever you're going in that direction, that's a bad idea. The president was furious the other day online that there are people in this country who came in under a special parole from Haiti and Venezuela when it was so chaotic in those countries. And now they want to kick them all out. And he was apoplectic that these people are entitled to due process. Why not just be able to kick them out? And he also, as you saw in that famous Oval Office meeting with the president of El Salvador, we caught him on a hot mic musing about homegrowns. Homegrowns are next, he said, and you're going to have to build 5 more prisons. Homegrowns, that's another word for U.S. citizens. And they're arresting these people. I was touring BIW this morning and I saw a guy with a lot of tattoos and I almost said, you better be careful because some of these guys being sent to El Salvador are being sent because of their tattoos. So with no scintilla that's my old law school coming back, scintilla, without any due process, any evidence whatsoever. So this is another place where the Congress has to step up.
Yeah, and say, Al's asking, what if my family member, if this happens to my family member, do they call your office, Senator King? Is there something else you recommend they do?
Yes, they should call my office because I have on my staff in Maine an immigration lawyer, which is, she's absolutely wonderful, very knowledgeable, and that's exactly what they should do when they run into a situation like this. Normally, we're dealing, you know, last year we were dealing with, you know, lost passports and that kind of thing. But now we do have these cases where people are being picked up off the street, not because of, and I'm not saying they're not bad people. There are bad people out there, and getting rid of bad people is okay, except we have in this country a basic principle of due process that the government, it goes without saying how dangerous the government is. If they can pick somebody off the street, send them to El Salvador, and with no evidence whatsoever, and then say, as they're saying now, we can't get them back. That should be chilling to everybody within the sound of my voice.
Senator King, is your office seeing these cases? Is your office hearing of these cases already?
Oh, I can't speak to that. I don't. There's a confidentiality, but I can say that we're very engaged. I have a whole group of people up here in Maine whose job it is to represent and help individual Maine citizens, whether it's a VA check that doesn't come, or you know, some problem with Social Security, or problems with immigration. So this is a service of the Senate office to try to help run interference for Maine citizens with regard to the federal government. But we've never seen anything like this before, where it's deliberate. And as I say, when you start with a quota, you're going to get bad results, because the people effectuating that are going to work to the quota, not to what's reasonable and fair and just in a particular case. And again, I'm not saying, you know, enforcement of immigration laws. I'm not saying we should keep terrorists and killers in the country. No, what I'm saying is we should honor the traditions and laws and constitutional provisions that have made us safe and free for 250 years. Because once you start down the road of saying, well, we're not going to pay any attention to this in this case, then you get to the place where who defines who the bad guys are? What you know, if they have tattoos, a certain tattoo we don't like, they're out of here. And that's, I can't express how dangerous that is. And we're already seeing it. As you mentioned, the people have friends who are being stopped at the border, who are naturalized citizens or who have green cards. They've gone through all the process, and all of a sudden they're targets. And this is a scary moment.
An email here from Emily. What can we regular Mainers do to help protect the Constitution? She writes, I am personally terrified with our current leadership and the destruction and disregard of the democracy.
Well, I think there are a series of things. One is speak out, be engaged, be involved. As I mentioned, apathy is not an option, but I don't think that's a problem with this caller. Engage with us, with your representatives. Keep the pressure on me and Susan Collins and Jared Golden and Shelley Pingree. If you have friends in other states, be in touch with them and urge them to be in touch with their representatives. And of course, be ready to vote in 2 years, but we don't know what the situation will be at that time. But the action now is to speak out, talk to your neighbors, be in touch, be visible in terms of resisting what's going on, because it's, as I say, I separate bad, which I think is a lot of what DOGE is doing. It's bad. They're firing people arbitrarily. They're gutting Social Security. They're doing a lot of bad things. But the other category is dangerous. And this business of picking up people off the street and disappearing them to El Salvador, of taking it upon themselves to decide what the law is, to decide what funding they want to do and not do, that's dangerous for the future of the country. So my advice to the public is be involved, speak out, keep the pressure on people like me. And I want to end on a positive note, Jennifer. This is a great country. We've been through some really serious problems. I think we're going to get through this. I think, I quote my friend Cory Booker, I was on the floor, not with him all night, but on the floor when he made that 25-hour speech, where one of the most profound things he said was, the power of the people is stronger than the people in power. And that's what we have to remind ourselves of, that the ultimate power in this country comes from the people. And that's who we have to hear from. They have to be engaged, and they have to take an active role in their community. And we're going to come through this okay, but it ain't going to be easy.
Senator King, we have about a minute left, and I want to go to Tracy's email here. She says that she is afraid that there will not be another fair, meaningful election, that there'll be some sort of declaration of emergency that permits normal laws and rules to be disregarded. She says, is there any possibility our electoral system will collapse into authoritarianism and fascism in the next few years or months?
Well, the good news is that our electoral system is really state by state. There's very little federal role in elections. And in fact, they're trying to pass various laws about elections, telling states what they can do. But the electoral system is state by state. And the good news is it's hard to hack into or disable 50 different systems. On the other hand, I know right now the president is considering declaring a whole strip along the southern border as a military zone of some kind, invoking the Insurrection Act, which gives him the power to use troops against American citizens. I hesitate. I believe we have a serious problem. I'm not ready to say we're not going to have elections, but I think we have to be, I think we have between now and then to fix this problem and to try to have the president come to his senses and go back to the fundamental rules of the road, which are in the U.S. Constitution. Thanks, Jennifer.
Thank you, Senator Angus King. Today's sound engineer, Jess Miller. Maine Calling produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hawk. This is Maine Public Radio.